Welcome to the Music 3.0 podcast from Plus Music. Today, we're sitting down with Drew Thurlow. Drew is a deeply experienced music industry professional, and after 6 years as the head of A&R over at Sony Music Entertainment, Drew founded his own music consulting business, Open Ceremony Media. We talk about how he started out as a session musician playing in rock and metal bands and was on Atlantic Records, and that's how he got his interest in music business to begin with. We talk also about the music discovery today, with things like internet, AI, and algorithms, and how it compared to the music discovery in the era of radio, TV, and magazines. So stay tuned, more from Drew Thurlow now on the Music 3.0 podcast. Drew Thurlow, welcome to the show. Appreciate you sitting down with Nick and I here for the Music 3.0 podcast. We know you're a veteran music industry executive, a former head of A&R over at Sony Music. We'd love for you to give us maybe a 2 to 5 minute bio of yourself here, just so our listeners can get an idea of who you are and a little background about yourself to start off.
Sure. Yeah, I started my career in music, actually as a musician. I was a session guy, played in rock bands, learned some recording techniques. I was in a metal band called Satanicide that was briefly with Atlantic. That didn't go too well, but I decided that the creative side of the business could be interesting. So I parlayed that into a job at Warner Music Group, where I was a marketing assistant, and then I was a marketing person, and then an A&R guy at the Warner Music imprint called Nonesuch. Mm-hmm. Spent 5 years there. This was in the 2010, 2011, a pretty depressing time in the recorded music business, probably the low point. Streaming hadn't launched or just launched. iTunes was the only game in town. People are getting laid off left and right. So I took a job at Pandora. And when I got to Pandora, I realized I was the first music person hired at Pandora, which had previously been kind of a sales and tech organization. It's been an extraordinary 5 years at Pandora. Not the least of which where I met my wife, who still works there, ironically. And I did a whole bunch of things when Pandora evolved from its kind of early days as a radio product to working more directly with rights holders, a lot of content. I did a lot of talent buying. Then we negotiated rights with labels, launched a full on-demand DSP. I spent 5 years doing that. And then I went over to Sony, where I was tapped to lead A&R in the Masterworks division. Spent 5 years there at Sony Masterworks as head of A&R, and recently left to start my own music consulting business. It's a big world out there. There's a lot of interesting things happening in music and tech, gaming, and AI. So I'm digging into that.
Love it.
Awesome. Let's dig in ourselves. So, why don't we can kind of go back and forth from things that you've seen and places that you've been, and sort of overlay on the way you see the world now and where you think it's going. And let's start with AI. It tends to be the conversation du jour. I think AI is such an infancy of what's possible there. There's only really one sort of game in town right now, which is generative AI, which isn't the only AI that you can build. There's all kinds of artificial intelligences that you can build. They're all replacements of thinking, right? So tasks, different things are going to be happening. Generative in the music space seems to be what people talk about a lot, is like train a model to make new music, make things that may or may not be necessarily new, but there's a derivative of it, right? We've had good conversations about that kind of stuff here on the podcast too, but it'd be interesting to see your thoughts on, like, how do you think, and I'll just pose a question, how do you think AI is going to affect musicians in general?
Yeah, the first answer is nobody knows, really. And if people are prognosticating on it, it's speculation at best. But I think there's a couple of things to note about what's already happened. Number one, it's kind of already here. Any pop recording or mainstream or any recording session these days is kind of a technological wonder. If you're using any kind of plugin, I'd say isotopes, ozone is responsible for most of the mastering these days. That's a heavily AI mastering program. It's there. Number two, I think the short term for the industry side is there's just a whole bunch more music when that's now being released. When I was at Pandora, we had the history of Western recorded music in our catalog. It's about 15 million songs or so. Now, 15 million songs are coming out every 3 months on the DSPs. A lot of this is because it's been the democratization of music making, and the assistant of AI has really kind of lowered the barrier to what it means to make music. So just dealing with that sheer volume of music is a challenge for everyone in the industry. And for artists, it's a competition. It's harder to get heard. It's harder to hear. And then you have kind of at certain levels of the industry, you have a real disruption where if you're a film scorer, or if you're a library music musician, or if you're making music for podcasts or short form video content, you know, you're probably already feeling it with these generative AI models that are easily making at least instrumental music that can replicate what you already did.
For sure.
Well, so if they're replicating what they already did, what does that mean to a musician's life, right? Like, so does that mean you need to be better? Does that mean that you need to make less music yourself and tool those AIs? Is the next musician going to be just basically a good computer programmer who's going to be able to put a new model together?
I mean, I think the next musician is not even that barrier. I think the next musician is, you know, some of these platforms are creeping up. There's one called Boomy, which is really popular. But I think the way that Boomy has proved that there's an audience for music making if you're not a musician. And for your listeners who aren't familiar, Boomy is a text-based music AI company where you can put in a text prompt and then the algorithm will kind of interpret what your text prompt means and then create a piece of music based around that text prompt. You can kind of take that piece of music it makes and you can, in a way that is not reminiscent of, not too different from like Candy Crush, you can like game in a gamified way, play with the sound and mimic it, change it, tweak it, you name it. And then you could press the button and it goes to Spotify and the rest of the DSPs. So it's early and Boomy makes what I consider to be like, you know, pretty bad instrumental electronic music. It's not great, but one of the things that we've learned about this AI culture is that it gets really good really fast. And I don't think we're too far away from the average musician being someone who's never learned how to play an instrument, never studied music, doesn't know theory, but they're able to make kind of credible music with some of these consumer level platforms thanks to the help of generative AI. As a session guy, as someone who, you know, knows theory and studied it, I don't know if that's terrifying or if it's amazing, but it's certainly putting the hands of music making into people who, you know, don't necessarily need a lot of background or training with it.
It actually reminds me, I mean, before we started taping the show here, the conversation we had about the tape machine in the background versus Pro Tools coming out. I think in order to stay in kind of that game for a while, you had to kind of learn how to use the digital DAWs. If I was just so stubborn and stayed in tape land, not to say I wouldn't be making still good sounding records, but clientele would be low. It would be super expensive with tape. Would you say that's similar to kind of what you see with AI tools in the next musician? It's not necessarily that you have to be an organic musician better than a computer, but you better get a little bit of knowledge on some of these tools coming out that your competition.
What if it was different than that though? What if being a musician's basically a text, you're prompt engineers, what they call it these days, right? Mm. So everybody's going to be prompt engineers. So would your encyclopedia of knowledge about music, like to be a musician, for example, today, what you're doing is you're basically, you hope you can get good enough musicians to make what you have in your head. If you're the one that's writing the songs and you're kind of orchestrating the band or the piece, you're hoping you can get in your group the best musicians you can find. And then musicians are interesting individuals to work with, and they come in all shapes and sizes, but it like if you're living in Iowa, in like Hamburg, Iowa, with like population 350, right?
Is that a real place? Hamburg, Iowa?
Yeah. It's like, it's not going to be very easy for you to find the best musicians in the world. So you're going to have to leave and go to the big city, which is what it's always been. So now you could be like, dude, I am on this person, this figurative person that we're making up is on Spotify, knows everything, great taste. In their head, they know exactly what they want, but they're like, you know what? I just need Daft Punk's X song bassline to just make me that bassline or something that sounds like. All of a sudden now your encyclopedic knowledge of music could become the way you prompt your way into the next hit song or the next really unique band, because but what you're not getting is that musician who's able to put their unique spin on it that you never expected. And then all of a sudden you're this band or that band or this band. But I think at the minimum, that barrier of entry to creation will go away with like, let me take something that I can articulate, which is what text prompt's all about in AI. It's just, I can articulate that. It's just the user interface. Like I'm sitting here texting on my phone lately. I'm like, why am I doing this? It's like, I should just be talking to this thing. It should be doing everything. I mean, we have text. It's not that great, right? Like iPhone's like text to message or whatever. But like on my computer, like, why am I pushing keys? Doesn't make any sense.
Why can't it just read my brain? Which, I mean, Neuralink.
It will do soon.
The thing that we've learned is that this stuff gets really good really quickly. And that process you just described about sourcing a Daft Punk baseline, creative musicians are going to find ways to use AI in creative ways and enhance the output of what they make. But, you know, I also wouldn't put it past a really smart AI algorithm to be able to find that Daft Punk baseline for you before you even really could articulate what you were looking for. And that is just like the promise of how powerful this can be.
I guess the big question, the devil's advocate of this whole thing is, will this homogenize everything? Will this turn it into, because, you know, ultimately what an AI is a model built on existing things. It's not trained or built to build new things. It's built to recombine things, right? And then we're using human reactions to the things that they recombine to be like, no, bad. Like a lot of early boomy stuff, like, no. But eventually that interplay between, let me put something out, get response, that's what OpenAI is doing at scale, right? Which is just rapidly learning too quickly, you know? And so we could jump off there, but it sounds like music creation's about to change, you know? Because when I was making music, I wish I could have been like, I just need the drum sound. I want my drums to sound like, you know, some Zeppelin track, right? And all I need to say is Zeppelin drums. I don't need to figure out what mics they were using, what location they were doing it, how to twist the knobs, all that stuff. All I need to know is what the end result is. And that's where people will get pretty soon, right? And I think that's cool. So now, that being said, now there's going to be, if there's 100,000 songs that come on Spotify every day, that's probably going to 10x. So there's going to be this deluge of content. Mm-hmm. It's just like it's going to be overwhelming.
Yeah. But that comes with its own challenges. I do know that the DSPs and some of the distributors are not set up for this, and they're not set up to be content farms and aren't built for their server space to be that full. So I think you're going to see a change in the streaming model. I think you're going to see a change in the pro rata way that things are paid. And I think you're going to start to see like not every piece of music created equal. And that's going to change the dynamic of what DSPs do, are, and how consumers engage with them.
Yeah. How do you feel like, you know, so with AI, for example, they're already working on it, but they will rapidly, like this idea of a metaverse has been on the, it's been a conversation for years, but it's always been too big of an idea and not enough execution on it, right? But I think now with training models, you'll be able to just, this is what Meta has been working on, which is the ability to create full, sort of like basically movies, right? And in this case, you turn that into 3D models and then put it on top of Unreal or Unity or whatever. And so ultimately, AI is going to build out vast expanses of metaverse and just digital worlds.
Yeah.
How do you see music showing up in the digital world space? Because licensing is going to be tricky, right?
Yeah. And it's a great opportunity for music and musicians. I think people are going to want music to be central and core to that experience, just like it is for 2D gaming now and has been. And I think people's relationships to artists are go beyond the music they make. So I'm not, you know, I don't think anyone is suggesting that real artists who have fan bases and stand for something and, you know, are inspirational, I don't think anyone is suggesting they're going to go away. And there's going to be gaming experiences and metaverse experiences where that soundtrack is going to be important and part of the experience. And then there's going to be other parts of the metaverse that are going to need a lot of music for a lot of worlds and a lot of content. That's kind of where the, you know, the low-hanging fruit of AI is, you know, to generate that. It's instrumental, it's royalty-free, it can change as the experience changes, and it's kind of more related to that specific instance in the game than it is to an experience outside of it. Mm-hmm. And when you I think what you describe is right. I think, you know, now that machine learning is caught up and you don't need human engineers to program worlds, like there's no limit to how many AR, VR experiences and worlds there are going to be. I don't think it'd be humanly possible to score all of that. It just will be too much. And that's where AI kind of comes in.
Well, that poses kind of a chicken and the egg question for me, or chicken or the egg question. What do you think will come first? Generative AI continuing to take away revenue opportunities because of its frictionless ease of use rights management, or PROs, master right holders, and publishing right holders figuring out a way to be more accommodating to these new experiences popping up that could, you know, ultimately be the future of visibility, discovery, consumption, and monetization for them?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think the answer is the commercial music industry, what people talk about are essentially like the big indies and the majors. They are going to be able to monetize and harness this power before I think it really starts to cut into what they do. The places where AI is going to cut into musicians' livelihoods is the places that these kind of big labels are not already trafficking. That, as we discussed, it's the people making music for Jingle Punks or sound libraries, or people scoring indie films, or the people making music for the TikTok library. That's kind of where I think musicians who do that kind of work, and it's important work, and it's employing real musicians, and it's cool, but that's just the lying fruit. But there's too much excitement at the big label side on the master rights holders about what you can do with someone's name and likeness and an algorithm trained on someone's data. And I've had some like kind of conversations in my work about, all right, well, you're say the Roy Orbison estate. And, you know, what can we do with his, you know, what can we train an algorithm and create a new Roy Orbison single? Can we license his voice out to somebody? There are some stems or some tracks that are sitting in a vault somewhere. He never finished the song. Up until now, there wasn't much you could do with it. Now you can kind of credibly make a piece of music that most people would recognize as pretty close to what he would do if he was still alive. So those opportunities are there. They're already happening, and there was going to be need to be some policing involved with that to protect the IP, but the growth and the promise of that is pretty big.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, look, so I have a friend in the business who said this. He was like, his son's four right now. He's like, I'm convinced that my son will follow a fully AI artist, like just top to bottom. It's an AI generated like property, right? And
guitar.
I was like, well, interesting. I was like, first of all, when? And say, probably not for 10 years. I was like, okay, cool. So that's a good timeline. 5 to 10 years is a healthy amount of time. Think about what's going to happen in 5 years in AI it's going to be a night and day difference. I mean, look at what happens in a month in AI world, right? It's just like crazy leaps and bounds, right?
Yeah.
What do you think about that statement? And because, you know, knowing what we know about music and the way, you know, there's marketing. You have to pull strings. You have to puppeteer something into the hearts and minds of people. You have to put it places. It doesn't just spontaneously arrive, right? Like even if you were to, I think that kind of fully AI artist, like where it's spontaneously made a look and a feel and a sound, all that. I don't know. I wonder if
I'm a little bit skeptical of that. I mean, outside of your novelties, like sure. Like there's an AI artist called Little Michaela. It's a novelty. It's like funny. I follow it. I'm like, oh, this is funny. It's the first bot artist. And I know Capital had with kind of disastrous consequences, they had one, that rapper at FK something or F.
Oh yeah.
That was, that was an example of like the consumer. Consumers being a little more, you know, for listeners who don't know the story, like, you know, a major record company trained a little bit of an AI model. And actually, I think it was more about some musicians actually composed and recorded the music. It was
just an avatar based artist. An
avatar replicating like traditional gang culture. And behind it was a bunch of like major label studio executives who like were kind of tone deaf to it. And, you know, they had to retract it. And then they ended up like, it's easy to, you know, when you cancel an artist, if they're actually an avatar, it's a lot easier to do that. You just press delete. So outside of the typical, like, you know, the interesting like novelties of that, I'm a little more skeptical. I mean, people's relationships with artists and musicians is so much deeper than just music and image. I don't think people want like an anthropomorphic Taylor Swift. I think they want the real thing. And I even though there's, you know, a vast sea change of the way music is made and where it's made and those dynamics are going to shift, I don't think we're going to give up the kind of the idol anytime soon. So I don't expect avatars to replace like pop stars.
So just for sake of argument, yeah. Right? Let's say Apple Vision Pros become a more of a staple in our daily lives, and this blended experience of theirs is a blended experience, but let's just say VR takes off, right? Which is basically what it's AR VR. So in this case, I could see an avatar-based artist that's you know basically powered by either real musicians or AI-based music, doesn't really matter. Ultimately, what those become are evergreen IP properties, right?
Yeah.
It's already happening in like every other entertainment space, games, movies, film, television, you know, all that. It's just comics, right? It's like comic books, never-ending characters like Superman, Spider-Man, Thor, all that stuff. So I think that there is something to that. If you rely on a real musician to be making the music, sure, the lifespan of like, you could start somebody, could make this great song, but has a face for radio, as they say. And so they put a avatar in front of that artist and they're making music. And maybe they manage to keep that person in the shadows and keep the artist like forefronted, right? maybe that person doesn't die in a car accident and is able to make music, and maybe they trained a model along the way, and so they don't even need the person anymore.
Yeah.
I could see artists like that exist because our entertainment experiences are going to be way less in real life in the future and way more these blended digital experiences.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I think that makes sense. And I think, I would say I would still kind of put that more in the novelty category than, you know, disrupting mainstream music. Mm-hmm. But that's an interesting thought. Like, if you have a driver that's a huge gaming franchise or a big Hollywood film, then
that's what Riot is doing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's more than just an avatar. That's a real IP that's beloved and people spend time with. Yeah. I could see that certainly becoming, you know, if that IP then makes music and releases music.
I think the difference between maybe our experience growing up with the only way you could see an artist play was on MTV or go see them live.
Yeah.
Or you hear them on the radio, but you can't see them. So if, you know, the kids today, they spend all of their time inside of video games and digital experiences in front of some kind of screen.
Yeah.
That's just how they do it.
I know. So, I was talking to someone. It's crazy. When I was growing up, I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island. And the only way to discover music was to hear it on the radio, which, you know, in the mid 90s in Rhode Island was basically metal, and go see it at Providence clubs,
which Lupos was,
yeah, basically metal. And, or I'd go buy magazines, music magazines at the grocery store. Again, mostly metal. So there was, you know, I got to college and, you know, in the late 90s, and I was like, oh, what's jazz? Like, it's kind of crazy how quickly curation and music discovery has gone from this really hard challenge, analog only, physical only, to just immediate, like a stock ticker for new stuff within a half a generation.
Mm-hmm. Well, wouldn't you even say that, hey, the analog version of what you're talking about is called Milli Vanilli?
I thought that when you were talking about like someone behind the scenes, I was like, let me tell the story of Milli Vanilli. And who this, I believe it was 1989. So if your listeners aren't familiar, this really good looking brothers had a massive smash. They got nominated for Best New Artist. They might even won Best New Artist at the Grammys.
They won a Grammy.
And then it came out that they were lip syncing. And the reason why they got caught is because they were performing a show and the backing track skipped. Like, if you're gonna like go through this length, like, wouldn't you make sure there's some kind of redundancy in the backing track?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
That was early. That was early technology, right?
It
you could stack two computers. You were working with one track thing, right? Like, there wasn't redundancy able to be done then.
They had
crazy thick accents, so they couldn't even.
You got to see it. It's floating around. There's a little like.
Yeah, if you go on YouTube. The moment it skips, like, one of them just runs off stage, and the other one does this like.
Dance.
They dance and act like it was part of the skipping, was part of the show. And you know what? It's really sad because they had a lot of trouble handling it, and one of them ended up committing suicide, sadly. And nowadays, though, would it be controversial if a pop star was lip syncing?
I think every single one doesn't today.
Yeah, I mean, it's really sad, like how cultural things change and how standards change, but it's really sad because.
I mean, those are guys that are sitting around going, F my life, because now you can.
Well, that's a guy.
All day long on TikTok and get.
Yeah.
You can have avatars. They were just doing it analog. It's pretty crazy. There is an actual awesome video floating around of that story. And when they got busted, they had these coaches come in who tried to teach them how to sing the songs, but they had such thick accents.
Yeah.
So they spent like 12 hours a day going through it. So, because their goal was to, here, fine, we'll give back the Grammy, but be able to stand up and sing the song perfectly. And just watching that struggle of them going, girl, you know it's true. By like yeah. they're coming up to the press conference, you could just see all the coaches going, this is never gonna work. We're gonna have to give it back. But very sad story. But yes.
Yeah. So look, I mean, ultimately, I think there's a lot of unknowns that's going to come out of what AI is going to enable, right? Like there's we're just talking about the things that we know of and we can see improve. There's just a lot of unknowns that are going to come around, right? So
yeah.
I think ultimately it's, you know, I like to think that eventually it'll be different camps of, oh, is that human made music? Like who made that? You know, oh yeah, we're on that camp, or people like just want to go see other human beings perform live, right? But people have been watching DJs dance in front of a thing for a long time, and that proved out to be very successful. So every time I think the purists think, oh no, people are going to appreciate real music, like someone just proves them wrong and does it like way less humanistic and it still works, right? Yeah. So ultimately, you know, maybe they figure out how to do holograms and there's just some fucking cartoon hanging out and it's just happening live, but it's not really live type thing. Or maybe something different, you know? Maybe something different. What are you working on right now? What's next for you?
Yeah, so I my consulting business, it's funny that you were talking about AI because I left Sony in earlier the year and thought I would be doing consulting in A&R, digital marketing, you know, your normal music industry stuff, and it's all AI. All anyone wants to talk about is AI. So I do have a stealth startup that more announcements will be coming soon about things in the AI space. And I'm really excited about it because, you know, the conversation we're having now is one I have all day with clients and partners and venture capitalists. And it's really kind of an exciting time in music. Although I was thinking about this the other day, it's funny. I got involved in music because I was a musician and I was a guitar player and I liked playing my guitar and I liked playing bass and I liked recording and I liked rock bands. And now here I am talking about like music technology and music as an asset class. And it feels pretty far from where I started, but it's been a really interesting evolution from that point until now. And I think your point about it exponentially changing and exploding is true. I just think we don't know where we're going to be in 5 years, and I'm just excited for the journey.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the Web3 space? It's kind of got a dark name now, and I always thought, Brian and I always, we talk about this, it was a pretty smart technology. Like blockchain's cool.
It gets a bad rap though, just because of the crypto crash. But I think, my friends in they're more aligned in the Web3 space, think that this kind of SEC regulation news this week, I believe.
XRP might, and stuff like that.
Yeah. Might actually kind of let people look back towards the blockchain technology as more credible, especially since a lot of the crypto associated with it might be a little more regulated. But I think the promise of that technology is really great. And I, especially on the rights management side, and there's a lot of companies like working in the blockchain for rights management, royalty collection. And that seems like an obvious thing that should happen in the industry, which, you know, despite all the disruption in the industry, there's still a lot of this like ticketing or like PROs that are just really kind of crazily archaic. So I think the promise of the blockchain will help solve some of those problems.
Let me ask you a question right there before you go on. So the promise of the technology is there.
Yeah.
Adoption is the bigger question. So I guess the thing I always thought to myself is like, are the people that really run the show incentivized to adopt this new technology? It's like,
no, they are absolutely not. No,
they, like there's no reason that they want to have clarity and they want to be sharing information and have it be on a public ledger. So ultimately, in order for it to really win, all of the new generation musicians need to just take a stand and say, we're going this direction, and build their own communities and businesses and enterprises on that on that other area and stake claim. Otherwise, the industry will keep pulling itself back into these crazy practices, which benefit the chaos that they kind of need to be able to sort of run it that way. You know, like that's where I think like the promise technology, there's a lot of cool tech. There's clean engines out there right now. Whether they get into our streets or not is the bigger question. It ends up being a money thing. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot. You're right. I mean, the industry has been managed by stakeholders who like the status quo. There's a couple of reasons why there might be some change. Number one, the Omnibus Music Modernization Act, which was the first major copyright law bill to pass Congress since 2000 or 99, did stipulate that some of this stuff has to be cleaned up. And so you have kind of like the legislation on one side, like forcing people's hands. Number two, like the technology just gets too good, and it doesn't, man. I don't mean to pick on the PROs, and you know, for your listeners who aren't super familiar with this, the PROs are the public rights organizations. They're your ASCAPs and BMI. They're responsible for collecting the performance right royalty of a copyright. So anytime your music is played at a bar, restaurant, at a sports stadium, or even on certain digital technologies like Spotify, and those PROs are, you know, they're big, heavy, they're bloated organizations. They employ a lot of people. The royalty collection is still surprisingly manual, and we're living in a world where basically every time a music is played, no matter where in the world it is, it's probably got a digital footprint. So that means the tracing and the tracking of that is probably pretty easy. And the blockchain is more than capable of handling that at scale. So there's definitely some startups that are interesting that are working to mimic that process. And in return, you don't have to pay a 12% fee off the top like you do to ASCAP and BMI. So I think, you know, the disruption is going to really happen, despite your point being really good about stakeholders keeping the status quo for their own benefits. I think you're going to get to the point where like musicians are going to stop needing the PROs. They're not going to sign up anymore.
Well, they don't. And the thing is like the PROs are not like the opportunity we've been talking about isn't, we've never said once in this conversation, oh, go tour. Oh, go, here's where the money is. It's on the road, or it's in the old ways to make your money, like sell records. No. So, all of the new, but the new versions of money making still fall into the purview of the PROs, right? So they slow down being able to put your music into games at scale or to get it into a metaverse. They just don't, unless they modernize themselves and unify, because like that metaverse is going to be played worldwide. Like Greece's PRO, which is a new one. I think the people ended up in jail over it. Like, it's, you know what I mean? There's too many PROs. No one talks. It's not a great system. And the only people that really lose are the new musicians.
Yeah. Right?
Which is why people are like, oh, sweet. AI-based music. Great. We don't have any royalties to like get screwed over on. Like, I don't think anybody doesn't want to pay for music. I'm sure there's people that don't, but if it was just easy, if I just plugged in, if I just said, you know what, I want music in this experience, plug, here's my credit card, bye. If that was the experience that you could give, which they do that in other great, profited businesses in the world, which is like, here's my credit card, just give me all of what I want. You can't do that in the music industry because of that.
Yes, it's hard, but I want to, you know, you actually stumbled on a really great point. And the recent, there's been two very significant, important music studies that just released in the last couple weeks. One is called Luminate, which is a company that kind of does a wholesale financial reckoning of the industry. And then Goldman Sachs did a big one. And their takeaway was that the direct fan to artist relationship is not being monetized enough. And that's because, you know, you make your money off Spotify. Well, Spotify is the one that keeps that data and keeps most of the money. Your label keeps most of the money. And, you know, for any artists or managers out there, you know, I want to plug someone that I follow who's really smart about this called Rob Abloh. And he has a newsletter called Where Music's Going. And he articulates a lot about how can you navigate this crazy new world where it's really chaotic and everyone's moving a million miles an hour. And he really advocates for like monetizing and prioritizing the direct fan to artist relationship. And you're right. It's not easy to do in a lot of ways, but you know, there's platforms that are working on it and there's like methods for working on it. And I think that's the best easy way for a young artist to really start to make this a career is to really, you know, your first 1,000 fans, pay attention to them, serve them, and, you know, and let them sponsor you in ways using technology and using some of these tools that Rob talks about.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I mean, look, they'll figure it out. There's enough passion in this industry. People love music. You know, I think one of the things that I'll be the most curious about with AI is that what music has always been is it's human. Good music is great. It's really human emotion and sound, and the great authors of great music, like people that with the craft and that have the talent, are able to craft something that lots of people can connect to, right? And so whether a computer can simulate that will be an interesting thing to see. But it's more than just making something that looks like something. It's more like, do I feel something? Hmm.
And yeah, when I was doing A&R, my kind of ethos was, I want to hear something I've never really heard before. And you're right. That's a uniquely human quality for now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we'll see. I think that's why I think the hybrid thing will be the one, because it'll still take the human and be like, no. Okay, that's it. You know, it's like you got these like witching sticks to like, you know, oh yeah, there's the water right there. You know, Drew, it's been good to talk, man.
Great chat.
Likewise. Let's make it a take two, and we'll catch up on the startup when you're ready to unveil all the details and tell us all about it.
Sounds good. I love it. Thanks a lot, guys.
Absolutely, okay. Drew. We'll talk to you soon, man.
Talk soon.